particularly through the morning, but even that tends to fade away. So a decent day for many. By the middle of the week, it looks like it'll be turning that bit wetter as a band of rain spreads in from the Atlantic.
Thanks, G. Now on Radio 4, our new book of the week is Historic Heston. Heston Blumenthal, with a little help from Hugh Dennis, explains how the inspiration behind the development of some of his most famous recipes comes from his passion for the history of British cuisine.
My eyes were opened to the potential of historical cuisine some 15 years ago when I first delved into an extraordinary 15th century manuscript known as the Vivandier. Among its pages was a recipe for a fish cooked three different ways that had flames coming out of its mouth. There was a recipe for making a roasted gosling, chicken or piglet appear to sing during service, and another for preparing a chicken that looked roasted but woke up just before carving and ran off down the table, upsetting jugs, goblets and whatnot, as the recipe says. Up to that point, I had little idea that the cooking of the past could be so audacious and playful. With our sophisticated modern technology and centuries of accumulated culinary experience, it's really easy to fall into the trap of thinking that cooking is more creative now than it ever was in the past. I started poring over old books. I began attending lectures. But it was only when I bumped into two amazing historians, Mark Meltonville and Richard Fitch, that my research took a massive step forward. In the kitchens of Hampton Court, Mark and Richard cook the recipes of the past as authentically as they possibly can, using the utensils and ingredients of that time. The knowledge that they've acquired is just encyclopedic. Soon after, I met another brilliant food historian. Walking into Ivan Day's kitchen was like entering a time portal. Bellows and salamanders hung from whitewashed walls. A fire crackled in a cast iron range rigged with a clockwork spit, and gleaming copper moulds were arrayed like sporting trophies on a heavy wooden dresser. It was a great place for me to get a truly hands-on appreciation of historical cookery. What started as an exercise in curiosity soon became something more. The cookbooks I consulted were leather-bound volumes with mottled pages and library numbers as long as the one on your credit card. It was tempting to view them as museum pieces. But as I looked at the form of curry, which was actually written by the cooks of Richard II, or browsed recipes with fanciful and intriguing titles such as Salmagundi, Ragu of Pig's Ears, or Tipsy Cake, I began to realise that I wanted to approach this not as a historian, but as a professional chef. I didn't want to reproduce the recipes of the past. I wanted to engage with these old cookbooks as sources of inspiration. Getting to grips with old recipes is, quite frankly, pretty challenging. The language can be as obscure as a secret code. Even now I'm not sure what a coolio is, and cookbooks of the past weren't designed to be reader-friendly. For a start, cooking tended to be regarded as a branch of medicine. Tracking down recipes meant ferreting among screeds of often bizarre remedies for wind in the stomach or swooning fits in travel. Before the rise of the domestic cook in the early 18th century, cookbooks weren't so much instruction manuals as aid memoirs. Measurements tend to be imprecise and directions can be tantalisingly vague. But then part of the fun of exploring these dishes was using my chef's instincts and experience to find the way through. Gradually, a set of loose ground rules took shape. I aimed to build up a wide spread of recipes, taking as my starting point the end of the 14th century, when the first extant English cookbook appeared. I'd stop on the cusp of the 20th century, when cuisine became relatively well documented and familiar. But within those parameters, I explored whichever recipes caught my imagination. For much of culinary history, chefs have had to make do with really limited equipment, cooking over an open fire, for example, until at least the 1700s. Now, I was under no such constraints. So if development warranted the use of a Thermomix, a Packagette, or a vacuum centrifuge, then that's what I chose. Nearly every recipe employs a water bath and sous vide machine. Now, this might not seem very historical, but one day it will be. In the 1850s, people were wary of gas technology and reluctant to cook with it. But by the end of the century, one in four homes with a gas supply also had a stove. Similarly, a few years from now, Almost every domestic kitchen will, I believe, have a sous vide machine and water bath, because they give cooks an unprecedented level of control. It's really important to me that the recipes take inspiration from British history and cuisine. Ever since I can remember, British food has been dismissed as exceptionally bad. Now, at times, there has been some justification for this viewpoint. I grew up in the 70s when our cuisine was probably at its lowest ebb. I can still vividly recall tasteless tomatoes and flabby sausages. And olive oil, well, you couldn't buy that in the supermarket. That's something you got from the chemist because you poured it into your ears when they were blocked. I can virtually taste the disappointment of biting into cakes that look delicious but just turn out to be bland confections of dense sponge and cheap over-whipped cream. But if, as history encourages, you take the long view, our culinary heritage is just a glorious one. King Richard II was a noted gourmet who gave magnificent feasts. Our invention of the pudding sent foreign visitors into raptures, and the Swedish traveller Pierre Carm observed in 1748...
The Englishmen understand almost better than any other people the art of properly roasting a joint.
Somewhere along the line, we seem to have forgotten that we did once have a great culinary reputation. But over the last decade or so, there's been a revolution in British food. And as a result, there's a newfound pride in this country's cooking that's led us to regaining our culinary identity. I hope to show how great cuisine comes from a sense of tradition mixed with the spirit of innovation.
The form of curry, 1390, rice of flesh. Tuck a rice and wash a hem clean, and do him in an earthen pot with good broth, and let him seethe well. Afterward, take almond milk and do thereto, and colour it with saffron and slat, and mess it forth.
In the British Library, there's a parchment scroll made of calf skin, scratched upon it in a spiky medieval hand full of curlicues and flourishes that make the script look almost like Arabic, at just under 200 brief entries, from ground in beans to pain puff. Some look familiar.
Chickens in gravy. Tartars of fish.
Many more are quite frankly mystifying.
Buchanan. Pain food new. Blank desire.
This is the form of curry, the oldest extant cookbook in English. Curry is Middle English for cookery, and this is an extraordinary piece of culinary history.
Compiled of the chef, Maester Cokes, of King Richard II, King of England after the conquest, the which was accounted the best and riolest viandia of alla Christian kings.
England was a troubled and volatile place when Richard acceded to the throne in 1377, at the age of just 10. His predecessor, Edward III, had made much use of ritual and pageantry to assert the court's authority, and Richard adopted similar tactics. Food offered an invaluable opportunity to show off generosity, wealth, and power. Richard's kitchen incredibly fed a household of 10,000 people on a daily basis. Hence his reputation as the best and realist viandier. It was the title Rice of Flesh that first caught my eye. It had a disarming frankness, a bit like calling a dish protein and carbs. But the ingredients also quickened my interest, especially the rice and saffron. I knew that the Arabs brought knowledge and rice cultivation to Spain when they invaded in 711, but I hadn't fully appreciated how early rice had become a part of the English diet. Nowadays, rice is viewed as a staple, but in the Middle Ages, imported foodstuffs underwent an arduous journey by land and sea. As a result, the exotic spices that flavoured medieval cuisine cost a small fortune and were carefully entered in household accounts, then kept under lock and key. Rice was brought in on the spice ships and was often stored securely with the pepper, cloves, cinnamon, ginger, and cardamom. A recipe with rice and spices was indeed a dish fit for a king. Even today, saffron is the world's most expensive spice. Saffron strands are the stigmas of one type of crocus, and they're so fragile that, as in medieval times, they still have to be picked by hand. It takes 70,000 flowers to produce 2.25 kilograms of stigmas, which, when dried, yield just 450 grams of saffron. The combination of saffron and rice in the recipe of rice and flesh made it look like a relative of the classic risotto milanese. The association offered a new direction in which I thought I could take the recipe. A few years back, I was researching risotto making in northern Italy, visiting farmers, chefs and millers to explore the basics, such as when to add stock to a risotto and in what quantities. Crisscrossing Piedmont and Lombardy, I made two discoveries I was particularly excited about. The first was the incredible flavour of aged rice. Amid the Renaissance magnificence of the Colombara estate, with its vast courtyard, Rinaldo Rondolino showed me how he lets Carnaroli rice mature in a temperature-controlled hangar for a year, allowing its sugars to develop and sweeten the grain, and its lipids to oxidise, releasing fatty acids that acidify the rice and harden it. Once rice has been harvested, most commercial companies grind it aggressively between stones, but this damages the grains with little pits and fractures, causing them to cook unevenly. Rinaldo, on the other hand, has machines in which the grains are ground slowly and gently so that the surface remains smooth. Such care produces rice that cooks to a perfect consistency and just has tons of flavour. My second discovery was at the restaurant belonging to the father of modern Italian cuisine, Galtiero Marchesi, who finishes his risotto Milanese with a small square of gold leaf laid over the rice, which he did simply to make it beautiful. But I like the historical appropriateness of adding gold to saffron, an ingredient once worth its weight in gold. Marchesi added what he called burro acido, butter flavoured with wine, onion and vinegar, during the resting of the dish, just at the end of cooking. This prevented the onion from dominating the other flavours. Moreover, since the wine and vinegar brought the necessary touch of acidity to the dish, the amount of parmesan could be reduced, making it much lighter. It was a clever, simple technique, and I just couldn't wait to start playing with it in my development kitchen. I reckon I could combine Marchesi's burro acido with another mainstay of French cuisine, beurre noisette, to introduce a flavour that would complement the slight nuttiness that risotto rice acquires when it fries in the oil before the stock is added. Eventually, I had something I was pretty happy with, a butter emulsion that gave the risotto a great balance of complex flavours. One niggle, however, was the flesh of the title. There's no mention of the meat in the original recipe. However, a little digging in the British Library revealed that another manuscript of the period contained a direct copy of the recipe called Rice in Potage of Flesh, and this confirmed that the flesh in rice of flesh must be in the good broth of the original recipe. In the Middle Ages, as now, a good saffron risotto called for a good chicken stock. This gave me the idea for the final element of the dish. My head chef at dinner, Ashley Palmer-Watts, brought back some calf's tail from one of his regular trips to our butchers. Now it looked delicate and had an attractive pale colour compared to the deep brown of oxtail. I figured it could sit really well with the other ingredients, enhancing their flavours but without overpowering them. It also occurred to me that since flesh features so prominently in the title of the recipe, it would be a crying shame not to have some of this on the plate. So we developed a method for cooking jointed pieces of calf's tail, first cooking them in a water bath until soft and moist, and then taking the meat off the bone and warming it in a sauce made from a red wine reduction and beef stock, another good broth. Finally, the rice is garnished with sprigs of earthy red amaranth and five pieces of calf's flesh. So the dish really does live up to its name.
Service, please. Two rice and flesh, table three, go.
Heston Blumenthal and Hugh Dennis have been reading from Historic Heston. The programme was abridged and produced for BBC Radio 4 by Jane Marshall Productions. Thank you. This is BBC Radio 4. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Tuesday the 15th of October. There are warnings of gales in Fitzroy, Shannon and Rockall. The general synopsis at 1800. Low, South East England, 1006, expected Humber with little change by 1800 Tuesday. New low expected Northwest Fitzroy, 1003 by same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours. Viking north at Zira, variable 4 becoming northerly 4 or 5, showers moderate or good. South at Zira, easterly 4 or 5 becoming variable 4, showers good. Forties, Cromarty, 4th, east backing north, 4 or 5, occasionally 6 at first, decreasing 3 or 4 later, showers good. Tyne, Dogger,